another piece, one more piece at the end. And I'll do that, but it's going to be or the middle of June when we do it. And you'll find out about that as we go through.
Is that the one that starts, "Our pastor was born in 1930?
No, no, I've done that one already. Yeah, that's a good one to start with, though.
Yeah.
So let's talk about where we are. We got through the fourth section of the history, and we got to the point where all of these things had come. We'd seen the rise of denominations. I've got some handouts, too. We'd seen a whole set of things happen, and they're heavy again, so.
Yeah, you need your back brace.
Yeah, and I'll try not to. Don't worry about it. It'll go away, man. So I can do that.
It won't go away. It'll go away now.
Now, okay. So we went through a lot of discussion about Gregory, Pope Gregory, and that was in around 600 AD, and he's the one that actually was the first one to be called a pope. We talked about him. We talked about how the church had fragmented, and they started to search for unity, and had come together under Charlemagne, who was a king of the Franks. And so the German tribes, and Charlemagne in French means Charles the Magnificent. So that's all that means, or Charles the Great. We talked about the papacy, and we talked about the fact that they were having so much trouble in Europe that one of the things they tried to do was to reclaim the Holy Lands. The Turks had come and taken over. The Muslims had taken it. But it was kind of an interesting discussion there, because there were four crusades, and we talked about those last week. And only the first one was moderately successful. The other three were just disasters. And the last one was one that they never even got to the Holy Lands. They just killed Christians over in what we call Istanbul now, or Constantinople. And that was really the split from the Eastern and Western Church, really the final straw in that. We talked about how once the Eastern Empire fell and all the people started moving back away from Byzantine and going back to Greece and other places, how it engendered a whole new refreshing study of the scriptures and back to the original ones, and how people begin to reject all this glory of the papacy and of the Eastern kings and Eastern primates as well. And they went to monasticism to try to go back to a simpler way of life. We talked about the problem with the popes. There were dueling popes. They had one. The cardinals didn't like what he did, so they named another one. The first one wouldn't resign. They moved, one of them moved to France, and one of them stayed in Rome, and they did that for 70 or 80 years. Finally, the church decided they had enough of that, so they deposed both and named a third one, and the first two wouldn't quit, so now you had three popes. And that went on for a while until finally they died off. And all of that time, the Reformation begins to play out, and a guy named Wycliffe in London starts a lot of Reformation talk, and he says that the church is really not the pope. The church is the people. It's not a matter of who the pope is or how many popes you have. It's the people. John Hus, Huss, I guess is the way you pronounce that, Jan Hus, John Hus, if you do it in English style, was from Czechoslovakia, or Bohemia it was called then. And he was a student of Wycliffe's, actually a student of one of the Wycliffe's students. And he began to look at the church in a whole different way. And he began to look at the church as a way of, it was all about the righteousness of God, and it was separated from the way the Pope had thought about it. And his big point was that the church on earth was not headed by the Pope, it was headed by Christ. Christ was the head of the church, and not the Pope, not the cardinals, not any of those guys. Well, you can imagine they got in trouble. Hus actually was one of the early ones to die in the Inquisition. He was summoned to give his reasons for what he was teaching, and they burned him at the stake. Then we talked about Luther up in Germany, and we talked about all that stuff, and how Luther really started this whole idea of what it meant to be saved, and how did you get saved, and saved, were you saved by grace or saved by works? He did a lot of discussion about that, and he got into some trouble, but I think because of the fact that the Inquisition had been so horrible, people all over the empire and all over the Christian faith really revolted against that. And so they kind of left Luther alone. He was a monk, and they made him go stay in his monastery and not cause too much trouble. He didn't do very well at that. He got out and taught in the neighborhood and converted really all of Germany to what we call Lutheranism today. And those just at the same time, all these other separatists were beginning to form. A group called the Anabaptists, which means rebaptizers or again baptizers. And these guys believed that that infant baptism didn't save them, and they had to be baptized as an adult, what we call believer's baptism. And of course, the church didn't like that either. And so some of those guys were actually killed as well. And the rest of them were drummed out and they went underground. We talked about all these great reformers, John Calvin and John Knox. He is the he's actually a Frenchman. His name is Jean Calvin, C-A-U-V-I-N, but we call him John Calvin. And he's the one that starts the whole idea of what we get Presbyterianism today. One of his students was John Knox, and so he converted Scotland, and we have Presbyterians that come out of that Reformed Church. The Anglican Church emerged. We talked about that and the fact that the King of England, this is no theological split. This was a split based on the fact that he wanted a divorce, and the Pope wouldn't grant it. And we talked about the political reasons. It wasn't honor that he didn't grant it. It was political reasons, because the Queen was the aunt of the current Roman Emperor, and he didn't want to get crossways with him, so he wouldn't approve it. So, King Henry just deposes them all, takes over the church, names his own bishops, Archbishop of Canterbury, names himself head of the church, dissolves his own marriage, marries Anne Boleyn. But it's all about heirs to the throne, and neither one of them give him a male heir to the throne. Two female heirs, Mary Tudor, and then also Elizabeth I, were children of each of those. The first one was children of Catherine of Aragon, who's his first wife, and then the second one was of Anne Boleyn. And his third wife, he had Anne Boleyn killed, and his third wife was a lady named Jane Seymour, and she gave him a son named Edward, who was Edward first or second. But he was very weak and had really no strength, and he was young when King died, and he only ruled for a very short time before he died, had no heirs. Then it fell back to the women, Mary, and then to Elizabeth. And so all of this stuff began to happen, and the Anglican Church went through just horrible churns back and forth, and they started splitting among themselves. And this is actually where the Baptists, or at least early roots of the Baptists, come out of, is this split. They're called separatists, and we'll talk a little bit about that. At the same time, the Catholics are reforming also, because they've seen all this chaos in the empire. They can't get the genie back in the bottle. The Lutherans are gone. All the Anabaptists are gone. All these separatists have split away. The English are gone. They're seeing their empire split. So what they decide to do is start this whole Catholic Reformation and put out a group that we call, it's called the Society of Jesus, I guess. It's the Jesuits. We call the Jesuits today. And Ignatius Loyola was the guy that started those. And you see Loyola University and a lot of things named for him. But Jesuits were the prominent evangelical movement that was very pushy, very strong, very aggressive, going into South America and all kinds of places, also over into Japan. America was beginning to be opened up, and it began to be the escape route. So people began to leave Europe, all these areas, and go to America. We had pilgrims, Puritans, Baptists, Congregationalists, Presbyterians, probably Catholics, Anglicans. They were all leaving Europe to come over here. And what happened, though, along the way is, in the old days, you died for your tradition. If you were a Catholic and somebody was arguing about something, you would fight to the death and die for that. And that happened all through here. People in the Reformation died for their faith. When they got to America, they had more things to do than that, and they weren't so concerned with that. And so the denominations came up, and denomination was really just a subset of a larger church. And so in America, we thought of the church as the worldwide group of Christians, of which Methodists were one. Methodists aren't here yet, but Lutherans were one, and some others, Baptists, Anglicans, Roman Catholics. We thought of them all as just a denomination within the larger body. And so all of that killing for that kind of stuff generally stopped here. And we see the rise of denominations, and that sort of gives us where we start today. We're going to cover the Age of Reason and Age of Ideology, and I'm going to kind of cut this one a little short, and then we're going to talk about, next time we do this, about what comes after that. Here's what we're going to talk about, and I'm going to blow through some of these pretty quick, because some of these you probably know already, but in the Age of Reason, what was it? What about the Wesley brothers? What was going on with them? The Great Awakening. What happened in Europe and England and here? And then the Age of Progress. What happened when all of the progress began to happen in the late 1800s, and you know, the printing press and all the other stuff is out, and you're beginning to see a lot of different things happen. And then what happens as we cross the 1900s, we come into a new area, an area of ideology, and how the rise of a lot of different things begins to come into play in the church. And we kind of get pretty current when we get to the global village and the spreading of Christianity and the spread of Muslim extremists. But so the cult of reason is this. Once the cat was out of the bag, so to speak, and once people began to determine that the church didn't have to tell them what to do every day, they could operate on their own, and the government didn't control everything they did, they began to ask a question about how do we change the way we operate because of that. And you can see here, if neither a divinely ordained king nor one established church establishes what's best, how does that change the ways we understand our lives? And so all of this became human reason and what we think and how we work. And along with that, the whole rise of mathematics and science and all that began to come into play as well. And it just fed into this. The more we learned, the more we understood how things work, the less we were mystified by the universe and by the earth and the motion of the planets and all that kind of stuff. And as we got into that, then it began to turn into the Age of Reason, and we began to see revolutions in all areas of society. We began to see them in our national areas, both here and abroad, political, religious, philosophical, and scientific. So we began to see a big change begin to happen in all of this. And, you know, one thing we got to understand, though, we always think about people come here to establish a place where they can worship freely. And some did. But the pilgrims didn't come to establish religious freedom. What they did was come to establish a society based on the way they thought. And the Puritans were the same way. They wanted to establish their own brand of authority within the colonies. And so you see different colonies begin to take on a flavor of different religions because people wanted an area where they could operate freely. And so all of these revolutions begin to take place. And so in the social order, we begin to see it's not the King of England anymore, nor it's the Pope, but it's the head of the Puritan church, or it's the head of the, you know, the Congregational church, or whichever church is kind of endowed within the colony to run the place. That's the way they do. A guy named Roger Williams, interesting separatist, came up with the idea that judges shouldn't enforce religious belief. See, up until this time, the state and religions were all the same. And if you didn't go to church or if you did something wrong, a judge would adjudicate that. We don't even think about that today. We think that the church and the courts are totally separate. But in that day, they weren't. So he, pretty radical thought. And then he also thought something else pretty radical is that we were over here taking the land away from the natives, and that it was really their land, and we shouldn't just be taken away from them. And for all of his trouble, he was expelled from the community. And so, you know, he ran for his life, actually, and went out into the wilderness and lived for a while. Some Indians took pity on him and took him in, but he was not a poor man. So he bartered with the Indians and bought this whole area, a small bay of what we call Providence today. So Providence, Rhode Island, was really formed by Roger Williams. And it was set up in order that he could set up a colony of what he thought. So under his leadership, this whole idea was birthed about a government that refused to favor any specific religious belief. I see where that's down below. I'll have to fix that. And it was not just Roger Williams. There's a lady named Anne Hutchison who said Christians were not bound to obey human laws. And that sounds pretty stark, but you know, we always say that we obey human laws unless they're contrary to God's law, and then we obey God's law. Well, that was really not something she could say, and she was teaching that in her little home Sunday school class, and they drummed her out of town. They brought her up before court, and you know, the courts in Puritan times were not, you know, pleasant places to be, and she had to flee out of Boston to come down to Providence because she could flee to Providence to escape the persecution. So Providence and Rhode Island began to be a sanctuary. And, you know, even today, if you know Boston or you know Rhode Island, they're not very far apart. But they're like New York and New Jersey. You know, they always pit each other against one another. And people in Providence kind of look down their nose at people in Boston. And people in Boston kind of look down their nose at people in Providence. And it's historical tradition, but it's all based on a lot of early American things that really were all religious-based. Just kind of an interesting thought. And then, of course, you know, 1700, we know about Salem. You know, the things got so bad that what would happen is the Puritan courts were so anxious to enforce their laws that if you had a whisper against somebody and you could bring them into court, then they were interrogated. And if they confessed, they were punished by the church, punished by the courts, and let go. If they didn't, they were burned at the stake as a witch, or they were killed as a witch. All of this began to happen, and you had a lot of people accusing other people. And, you know, human nature the way it is, if you've got somebody you don't like, you just accuse them of being a witch. And now they're in for the time of their life in front of the Salem witch trials. And so and it's become part of our vernacular, right? If we're looking for something, we're going to say, well, they're on a witch hunt. They're trying to find something bad. You know, we don't know that there's a witch there, but we're going to find one, you know, because we're going to look for it. So this whole thing up in Salem began to happen. And, of course, that was terrible. And it was really a black mark on the Puritans because they allowed it to go on and even fomented it. And it really comes to bear on the whole idea of that when you get power, an absolute power, and you can control people's lives, it's a very dangerous situation when it becomes very emotional tied to that. You know, you can see here, trials is spelled the way they spelled it back then, T-R-Y-A-L-S. And you can see a famous guy here named Cotton Mather who wrote this little article up there. But, you know, they had all this newspaper coverage of the witch trials, big time stories. You know, people gathered to read it all. And 19 people were killed in Salem. But 50 were accused. The rest pled guilty to save their lives, and 19 were hanged. And so it's a black mark when we look back on the Salem witch trials and wonder about it. The Puritans were trying to drive Satan out of their colony, and they thought Satan was there. And if you did anything mysterious, and people who just think for a minute, we have if you were to go, I'll just kind of hop off the track here for a second. If you go to Kroger at 11 o'clock at night, any of you ever been to Kroger at 11 or 12 o'clock at night? There's some strange people that come in there, right? Okay, so think about for a minute strange people coming in out of the hills. Yeah, Charlie is the one I'm talking about. But, you know, you go there, and if you're a little bit mentally off, you don't. There's no mental health facilities. If you, you know, have a little problem talking, if you act funny in any way, you know, they thought you were possessed. And so people were just drummed into this, you know, for no reason at all, and became a real, real hard time. The other thing that happened is there was a guy named Sir Isaac Newton, and any of you who ever studied, you know, mathematics or science, remember him. And what he did was he developed a mathematical theory for things in motion. So if you had moving bodies, like heavenly bodies or anything else, he developed and used calculus to show the predictable reactions of how they are. It's the underpinnings of everything we do today with motion, mathematics, or anything to do with it. But in that day and time, they didn't understand that, and they thought everything to do with planets was mystical and God-ordained, and that they could never know. And when Isaac Newton actually developed theories, and they were actually published in books, then people begin to say, well, if he can explain the universe and we see that the moon orbits and we know we can tell when it's going to orbit, we know what's going to happen because we've studied this, then what else don't we know? What else? Because human reason is now getting smart enough that we can begin to decode all of this stuff in nature. And, of course, one poet made the comment that nature and nature's laws lay hidden in night. God said, let Newton be, and then all was light. And it's kind of interesting because Newton was considered to be the guy that brought light, you know, to this group of reason. Now, I don't know what his religious upbringing was. I didn't look him up. But his intent was mathematical and scientific, not to change religious dogma. But it happened because all of this stuff was happening at one time. And so all of this, all of these possibilities and all these changes begin to just drive thinkers to think about how to discover truth out of nature and other ways. And this is what we call the Enlightenment. And it all focuses on a couple of things. It focuses on individual reasoning, what we think ourselves, the words that we use, the science and the natural order, rather than God or the Bible. So all of we begin to put the order of science, the scientific things, in one bucket of truth, and the Bible begins to, its bucket of truth begins to dim a little bit because people weren't going to it for truth as much as they used to. So all of this is what is called Enlightenment, and if you look at history, the Enlightenment period. And we still see that today. In today's world, you know, people have totally divided science and biblical thought. And rather than understanding that science is a gift of God that He's given us and that they should be in harmony, we've divided them up, and we think if you're a scientist, you can't be a Christian, or if you're a Christian, you can't be a scientist. And those really are not the same thing, and they're not the same thought. But we all fall prey to that line of reasoning. Western philosophy began to develop here with the whole idea that everything we know, we learn from our philosophy and cultural life. So it becomes, if I don't see it, if I don't feel it, if I don't hear it, if it's not part of my five senses, then it's not real. It can't be real. I can't believe it. It's not. You got to prove it to me. And, you know, and we still have, that's very prevalent today. You know, we talk about evolution, and we talk about creation, and they say, well, you can't prove creation. Well, they can't prove evolution either, but and that's a different story for them because evolution comes out of the scientific world as a theory, and all of the other creation comes out of the biblical world as not a theory, but as a statement of fact in Genesis. But they can't do that. With human reason and the five senses crowned as king, mystery, including the twin mystery of tradition and authority, which is the church, is banished. A God who intervenes in human history is viewed as irrelevant. And this began to be the thought process for people in this time of enlightenment. Now, the bad part about this is about the time when our country is going through its separation from England. And so this French philosophy, French culture of reason, and all the stuff is coming over here about the same time. We didn't talk about the Bastille. I'll mention that later on. But all of these, I won't say all of them, a lot of these guys embrace something called deism. And I talked a little bit about that before. But the ones who weren't deists, by the way, most of them were either Unitarians or they were Congregationalists. And if you look at the people that signed the Declaration of Independence, we know of about six or seven of them. We could probably name them off. And we could, you know, you've seen discussions about Thomas Jefferson, about, you know, John Adams and all these guys, and you know kind of what their religious thought was. But the other 40-some-odd, we don't know anything about. There's a new book out. I don't remember the name of it, but it was one that just came out that talks about all the founders. And what you find is surprisingly a lot of them were Christians. The ones you hear about are not Christians. They're deists. And so we think all of the founders were deists, and they're really not. But a deist looks for a way and a platform, common platform, that everybody can agree on. Just kind of the words that make everybody agree. And they believe that the divine being had created the universe, but he's like a watchmaker. He's wound the watch up. He created the watch. He's wound the watch up. He sets it on the shelf, and the watch ticks as long as it's planned to tick, and God doesn't have anything to do with us. He's not involved with us personally. The watch just ticks. He's the watchmaker, and they viewed him as the watchmaker. So they didn't think of a personal relationship. They thought of this, you know, global God is in everything. God is in the trees and the grass and everything. And so deists were spiritual, but they were not relationship-oriented. They had no relationship with Jesus Christ. And, of course, Thomas Jefferson is one of the most famous one of these. And he had some belief in Jesus, because if you read his letters, you'll see a little bit of that. But he also, when he produced the family Bible for his children, he took out all of the miracles. He took out the book of Revelations. He took out the book all the books that had any supernatural things in them, he edited them out because he didn't believe that his children needed instruction in that. He wanted them to learn the lifestyle that Jesus had. He wanted them to learn the Sermon on the Mount. He wanted them to learn Christian behavior and not who Christ was and how he, you know, controls our life. And so you don't hear a lot about that, but, you know, interesting guy, smart guy, absolutely fundamental in founding of our country. He and Madison and Monroe and Adams. Adams was more of a Unitarian. Mm-hmm. He was in the Boston area, Unitarian. And he was a more of a Christian than Jefferson was, but he was pretty weak on some of his theology as well, at least the way we look at it today. But he was a lot stronger than most of the deists were. So, again, they saw value in Jesus, but only as far as he was a good prophet and told us what to do. And we talked about in the early church how they got away from teaching who Jesus was and started teaching behaviors because they wanted to teach us how to behave as Christians, but they really didn't want to talk about who Jesus was. And was he fully God? Was he fully man? Was he divine? Was he the same substance as God? Or was he not? Was he created by God, or was he part of God? All of the questions that you ask as a Christian early in your pilgrimage, they didn't want to deal with because they didn't understand them, and they didn't really want to accept them by faith, so they just didn't talk about it. And so they talked about the teachings, and deists were kind of in that mode. They were looking for something common. They didn't want to get into arguments with anybody, so they just sort of took them out. So their whole idea was to live according to Christ's ethics. And, you know, a lot of people feel today, well, you know, I believe in God, and I'm a good person. You know, I don't break any of the Ten Commandments. I'm a good person. You know, if God's a loving God, I'm going to go to heaven because I'm a good person. And I believe there's a God. But they don't have a relationship with Jesus Christ. And so, you know, in many ways, a lot of our citizens today are deists. They don't know that they are, but they are, because that's kind of where they are. They're spiritualists as opposed to believers in Christ and, you know, the narrow way, as we would call it. But even during this time of darkness, even during the time when the cult of reason and all that was taking place, people were praying, and most of these were Congregationalists that were down in the, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, West Virginia, all of that, where most of the Congregationalist churches are today. And so, you know, Quakers, Shakers, Mennonites, Old Order, Amish, whatever you want to call them, you know, and then all the spinoffs of those that are in, you know, the Brethren churches and so on. They started praying that God would come back to America. And we began to see this great awakening. It didn't start here. It actually started in Europe. And, I fix all this stuff, and then when I put it on, it just goes back to the way it was earlier. Europe, there began to be a whole set of prayer meetings going around a couple of verses, 1 Thessalonians 5:17 and Leviticus 6:13. I've got both of those in your handout. But this one says, pray always. And somebody read for me if you're on that page, Leviticus 6:13. Somebody have it there?
The fire must be kept burning on the altar continuously. It must not go out.
Okay, so the two ideas were, you pray around the clock, and you have somebody is always in a sense of prayer. And those were the things they did, and they prayed for this revolution and revision in religion, and it began to happen. Now, we don't think of this as Zinzendorf and don't think much about him, but Moravians are kind of interesting folks. We'll see how they play a role in our own history a little bit later. A guy named Jonathan Edwards, some of us have heard about. He was in Northampton, Massachusetts, and he began to, he was a member, pastor of the Congregational Church, and he began to preach a fiery sermon about being saved and coming to God and the resurrection. And 300 people came to join his church, and he was kind of a devotee of some other things that were going on, and he began to change his style of preaching, and so he was one of the early names. Okay, great. Going crazy. Hold on, man. Let me get back here. John Wesley shows up and his brother Charles, and they're in England, and John is a Anglican priest. We'll go back to this one, and he starts teaching a class at Oxford, and his brother Charles is there, And Charles is a student there, and he is absolutely beside himself because of the Unitarian influence coming into Oxford. And so he begins, they begin teaching these Bible classes, and they begin to go back to the principles of the faith, and they begin to drive away some of the heresy that was beginning to creep in. And they got pretty good, and they developed this little scheme for how to do that. And there was many names they were called, but one of them was Methodist, and that name kind of stuck. But they were part of the Anglican Church, and they were Methodist, a Methodist movement within the Anglican Church. And so they were getting successful, and one of their one of his professors got him signed up to come over to Georgia and come down into Savannah, where General Oglethorpe was running, you know, that part of Georgia. And John Wesley became his chaplain, and Charles Wesley became his sort of aide-de-camp or his secretary. And for about 2 years, they ministered in that area, but they got into a lot of trouble because John Wesley had this kind of a English idea of how the church ought to run. And so when the ladies would begin to wear jewelry and fancy dresses to come to church, he was all over them. I mean, he was preaching hellfire and brimstone, telling them, you know, that they really need to get away from that. And of course, they almost ran him out of town. And so what he does is he sort of backs off of that a little bit, but he falls in love with the daughter of the mayor of Savannah. She doesn't want any part of it, however. And so in this inset back and forth between the two of them, he accuses her of something or says something about her family. So they haul him up into court for slander. And so Oglethorpe gets him off and gets him on the first ship back to England. So he's headed back to England with his brother. And they're beat. They don't understand. They thought God had sent them here, and you know, God had just kind of whipped them into little piles of jello and sent them home. But along the way on the ship, they met this group of Moravians, and Moravian Pietists they were called, but they're Congregationalists, and they really had a deep sense of faith, and they were real close together. And so he was very much taken by them, and by seeing their faith, he was thinking about how poor he was as an example of Christian faith compared to the Moravians. So it's kind of interesting. He goes back to England. He goes back to work. He can't get the Moravians out of his mind. He calls a young pastor who's a Moravian pastor who comes over, who tells him about being born again, and he and his brother are both accept the Lord. They've been preachers in the Episcopal or in the Anglican Church, but now they understand they had been all head knowledge. Now it was heart knowledge, and so they accepted the Lord, and they began to start this whole thing, still in the Anglican Church, called the Methodist Movement. And all of this began to happen in England, and they began to train lots of people. And these Methodists, who were Anglicans, some of them came to the U.S. And when they came to the U.S., a couple things happened. One is they were not part of the Anglican Church because the Anglican Church was not very much here. So they established their own denomination called Methodist here. And some were Calvinistic and some were Arminian, and we talked about that before. But George Whitefield becomes the first famous Methodist preacher. Big-time preacher, and people in the American colonies were coming to hear him preach. And he would come to, he lived in England, but he would come back and forth and preach almost like revival services over here, except they were in large churches. And Jonathan Edwards, the guy we talked about before, heard Whitefield, and that moved him to change his preaching style. And so he began to take on the characteristics of this new thought of Methodism. And people called it the Great Awakening because people were coming to know the Lord at a fast time. And pastors began to do this evangelical movement within the churches, but at the same time, the political system is trying to break away from England. And so they're trying to declare their independence. And so the great fires of the Great Awakening begin to fade as preachers begin to focus on how do we stay alive, focusing on the revolution that was to come. And so some of these great fires begin to fade away. They didn't go too far, by the way, because many of the pastors were Anglican in heritage, and they loved England. They hated the king, but they loved England. And so they did not want to break away. Others favored revolution. They thought that America was the shining city on the hill. It was God's gift to them to come and create a Christian nation. And so many pastors favored it, but guys like John Wesley opposed it because they were Anglicans fundamentally. But in the end, of course, we know the story, and the United States won its independence from Britain. And interestingly enough, in the Bill of Rights, the third article in there is the article that was proposed by Roger Williams, which is the one that says Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And we know in today's news, that is all the time in today's news. Of course, the founders had no intention of stopping religion. What they wanted was, they wanted the government not to push one over the other. They learned fairly quickly that for anybody to have religious freedom, they had to grant religious freedom to all. And so that was the purpose of this, was to grant religious freedom and to keep the government from sticking their nose in to religious situations. And you can sort of just tell where we've gotten over the years with that. Gosh, I need to fix this. Sorry. The American creed, by the way, you can look at this, but the Great Seal of the United States, two things I want to point out to you. One of them is Annuit Septis, and that's, first of all, this is an unfinished pyramid. The eye of God is looking over the unfinished pyramid as it's being built. It's got the date of independence here. Annuit Septis, or I don't know how you pronounce that. But anyway, it means, what's it mean there? Somebody got it written down there. It means God will what? God will what?
Favors our undertaking.
So God has blessed our undertaking. And then this Novus Ordo Seclorum, what does that mean?
New order of the ages.
So it says that God blesses our undertaking, which is a new order of the ages. They thought that this was really the start of a new venture for God here. And in the other side of the crest, you know, it's got a pluribus unum, which is a from many, one. And it's really talking about all the people who come here making one nation, all the different thoughts building one nation. But all of this became early symbols that were attached to the money supply, to the buildings and all the things. You see these symbols all over Washington if you go up there. And so all of this began to happen in the new order, which is, of course, America. One of the preachers began to preach and had a couple of questions. One of them came out of the book of Isaiah, Isaiah 66:8. Who has ever heard of such a thing? Who has ever seen such a thing? Can a country be born in a day or a nation be brought forth in a moment? Yet no sooner is Zion in labor than she gives birth to her children. This was a text that was very appropriate for the founding of the country. It's also appropriate for the founding of Israel. A lot of texts are in here that are kind of dual purpose. Lyman Beecher, who was a very famous fundamentalist preacher who was Presbyterian up in the Northeast, Boston, I believe, used this as a sermon for what he called a plea for the West. And it was really a plea for settling America and opening it for Christ and doing all of the work. Now, we know him because he was involved in the abolition movement of slaves. Harriet Beecher Stowe, his daughter, was involved in, you know, writing books and other kinds of things about against abolition. Very, very oriented towards changing the culture that was so dominant at this time in America. But America was not like it is today. It was rough and ready. You had the big cities of New York, and if you ever watched any of the TV shows like Gangs of New York, you know that was kind of a deadly place to be. But then you had the countryside. And if you were too far outside the city, you had Indians and outlaws and renegade Spanish if you were in the middle part of the country, and other rough people in the country that would kill you for your water or your horse or your blanket or your gun or anything else. It was a tough, tough time. But what needed to happen was a set of rough and ready circuit riders, preachers, needed to develop. And what happened was two things. One is this whole movement of Wesley started a common group of pastors beginning to think about how they move out away from the churches and minister. And so you had circuit riders that were Baptist, you had circuit riders that were Presbyterian, and circuit riders that were Methodist. And they would take a territory, and they would ride, and they'd preach in one town this week, and one town Tuesday, and one town Thursday, and, you know, they would make this route, and people began to expect them to come. And it began to be an interesting time, and they began to preach to the countryside and change people. And something happened kind of interesting. The camp meeting really starts it's actually a little before 1800 or 17. I got the date here in a minute. But a lot of people out there in the country were kind of universalists. They didn't really know much about God. They hadn't been formally trained. They'd heard a little bit about him, but they never thought that God was after them or that they had to do anything, that God was just there. And, I guess some of it comes from the Indian culture of the Great Spirit and all that. But there was a lot of universalism out there. And so a lot of this was people were really apathetic about God. They didn't know anything, so they were spiritually dark. They were also apathetic. But this whole movement of pushing out into the frontier began to happen. And camp meetings were one result of that. And in Cane Ridge, Kentucky, 1801, the first really successful camp meeting happened. And so a preacher is coming down, Barton Stone, and people come from 100 miles away. They ride their wagons. They know they're coming. They come to listen. They expect 10,000, which sounds like a lot to me, but they end up with 20,000. And hundreds of people give their life to the Lord, and they get baptized, and they repent, and they turn to God. And this becomes really the start of camp meetings, but it also begins the Second Great Awakening as it moves away from the cities and begins to go out into the countryside and begins to light the fire of God all over the country, and people are converted, and people come in, and you begin to see churches being built out into the hinterlands and all of that kind of stuff. And of course, America is not acting by itself, because Europe is ticking along doing its own thing, and the age of progress is beginning to hit in Europe as well, and the influence of France on the Catholic Church. When France overthrew the French kings, and the Bastille was overthrown, and the monarchs were killed and run out of office, and the common people took over, you had a hatred for the Catholic Church, because they represented the government. They were part of the old order. And so this whole age of progress, if you want to call it that, had a dramatic effect on the Catholic Church. And one thing you understand is the devil is democratic. I don't mean that politically. What I mean is the devil, it doesn't matter whether 10,000 people tell a lie, it's still a lie. If a million people tell a lie, it's still a lie. But in democratic societies, the more people who believe something, the more the government begins to go in a certain way. And so they began to understand that there was no way they could combat what was going on in France. So they went into a fortress mentality. They retreated back, and they bit back the only way they could. I mean, they fought. They tried to excommunicate people. They tried to declare all kinds of things against them. But the people didn't care. The peasants had it too long. They'd been ruled by noblemen and kings. And I've got a statistic on this. I think maybe it's in the notes. But of the 25 million people that lived in France, only 200,000 were either noblemen or aristocrats or church clergy. The rest of them were all peasants, and they were treated like peasants. They had no rights. They couldn't do anything without the approval of somebody else. And so they were going to take this Bible. So fortresses, have a unique thing. They can protect, and if somebody's attacking them, they can they're very defensive, but they don't move very well. And if you're inside a fortress, you can't see what's going on outside. And so this is what really happened to the Catholic Church in this particular era. They sat in their fortress, and they didn't come outside for 100 years. And the world moved, and they didn't. And they began to get further and further back. But they began, as I mentioned before, they set this group up called Jesuits, who were ministering in South America and other places. And so the candle of mission was burning for them, even though they in their fortress couldn't see what was happening. The candle was burning for them in other places. They weren't aware of it. And, we see this today, don't we? We talk about the Washington mentality. Or if you've ever seen the picture, and I always laughed about it until I realized how true it is. If you ever see that picture that was in New Yorker that shows a New Yorker's view of America, and New York is huge, and all the rest of the states are like little dots pinned around it, because their view is New York is everything, and all these other states are kind of flyover states. You fly over them to get somewhere else. And that's really the way the church felt. All these other groups are flyover groups. We're as long as we hold tight, we're going to survive. And so the church took a real hit in this time of of history. Now, the New Age had its promise, human growth, human reason, human understanding. So they had a lot of confidence in a human's ability to cure things and to build a utopia on Earth, or, you know, create the perfect society for all of us to live in. And a lot of that is characteristic of the modern age. And what happened was, in the churches, since the churches were squabbling, especially in England, they're squabbling with one another, nothing was happening outside. No ministries were taking place. And so volunteer groups began to be set up. And you have the basic volunteer groups like the Salvation Army, the Bible translation groups, the people that food for hungry, prison ministries, all kinds of ministries. The YMCA, the YWCA, a lot of those things begin to set up as single-purpose volunteer organizations. And one of their biggest efforts was against stopping slavery. And, of course, the British, you know, were tantamount early in creating the market for this and carrying slaves back and forth. And so they finally bludgeoned the British into stopping that. And, of course, it was, you know, perfectly well picked up by the Spanish and the Portuguese and the other people to sell slaves and get, you know, get it on the money. But they drove that out of England, and so one of the things the church did was just respond to all of the negative things and turn to a voluntary, a mission type organization. But the church resisted that. They wouldn't harmonize themselves. They called this Vatican Council in 1868, and of course their answer to this was to declare that the Pope was infallible, and anything that he made was an infallible choice. And the other thing he did, which is, and we hear this today when they talk about the Pope will issue something ex cathedra, which means from the chair. So what the Pope did here is the Pope made some rulings that he didn't get concurrence with the bishops, he didn't get any council call, he just made a ruling. And since he'd become infallible, the ruling was an absolute binding ruling on the church. And so now we call those, when the Pope issues a ruling like that, it's called ex cathedra, which means from the chair. So he didn't get a lot of advice, he just did it himself. And so that's, and so this was their answer to the modern world, is they were going to retreat into the castle, declare themselves king, and whatever they said was law, and people had to obey. Problem is, people didn't obey. D.L. Moody rejected the modern age. You know, he had his own problems, and I won't go into those, but you know, he considered the world a damaged, wrecked vessel, and that you needed God to fix it. And he tried to share a very simple gospel. He went away from all of this stuff. And, you know, you can't run away from knowledge, but you have to harness knowledge as part of a message that makes sense to people. And so he began to go for very simple theological studies. And, you know, he's popular, of course. But all of these voluntary organizations began to appear, evangelistic preaching. Charles Spurgeon, one of the popular, he's a Baptist preacher, actually a Calvinistic Baptist preacher, who started preaching. And he started preaching, as did a lot of other things, about slave trade and American, he was in England, and slave conversion. And what happened was, a lot of the owners of slaves began to think, they're going to cause me less trouble if they're Christians, because they're going to understand their role as a slave, and they're not going to, you know, do what they have done. And so they started allowing their slaves to learn. And all of these slaves begin to learn and sing these spiritual gospels, mostly based on, you know, the coming out of Egypt and a lot of the deliverance kind of themes that were so popular because they were so depressed. But all these organizations, and I've kind of talked about those already, but all these things begin to happen, and they changed forever the way the church ministers in the world. Charles Finney was another preacher. He became a Christian one day and a preacher the next. Kind of a short span, but I guess if you've got a word from the Lord, you can share it whenever you have it. He became a popular guy. You know, he was trying to get African Americans to attend, and he encouraged women as well as men to do that. A lot of churches charge what they call pew rent, which is the Jewish church does that today. You know, where you have if you belong to the synagogue, you pay a fee, and that fee is your seat cost for the year, and it's kind of like a building cost, a maintenance cost.
And the closer down the front you get,
the more expensive it is. So, in the Baptist church, you need more back pews than front pews. So Finney discouraged that, and he embraced the poor, and he had a lot of people coming into his churches, and you know, a lot of things, you know, he rejected original sin, things that we don't today, but he was a powerful preacher. He just was a little off in the way we would view, you know, thoughts. He claimed Christians could be morally perfect in this life. So some of the things we see as heresies in today's churches, we don't have to look very far in church history to see examples of them, you know, 50, 100, 200, 300 years ago. We don't have to go back 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he thought conversion was something we did because it was a smart thing to do as opposed to an act of divine grace. But he got a lot of people to come and listen. He got a lot of people, you know, to take his version of Christianity. Spurgeon, we talked about him, Calvinist preacher. Really a guy that preached to a lot of people. One of the first guys to preach to so many people. And, of course, in an era long before radio and television. I've mentioned this before. He spoke out against slavery. But there's a lady in our history called Sojourner Truth, if you've ever heard of her. That wasn't her real name. Her name was Isabella, and I don't know if she had a last name. But she was an American slave who had been freed in 1843, and she witnessed the gospel and been converted. And she began to travel all over the land teaching others about Jesus. And, you know, showing their sins and calling them to see the need for social reforms, the largest of which, of course, was, you know, the whole idea of slavery. And she became very popular, almost a cult figure in the African-American community for early style of preachers. We, you know, we see most of them today are men, but in the early church, a lot of them were women because the masters wouldn't kill them. They would allow them to do some things where the men, they wouldn't because they were afraid of them. So, it's kind of an interesting back and forth on that. Civil War begins. You know about that. Christians on both sides divided up, and the Christians in the South supported the South, and the Christians in the North supported the North, and they thought about, you know, things that supported slavery, and they thought about things that didn't support slavery, and it just became a huge problem. And a lot of people will tell you this is the cause of the Civil War. It certainly was one of the causes, but I think probably other causes are every bit as important. This war was fought because of the whole issue of who tells you what to do. You know, the states joined the Union on the assumption they would become like little independent countries working in a confederacy where the federal government had limited power. And what we see is that's not the case. And, you know, you can credit Abraham Lincoln with holding the Union together through force, which he did, but the question of states' rights has never really been fully resolved in this country,
right?
You know, because it was resolved by force and not by any common agreement among the people. And we still see that today. You see it in states bucking the federal government. You see it in the federal government taking powers away from the states. There's still a lot of issues that come around here that were not solved. They were beaten into the ground, but they were not solved at this time. Now, I want to build a picture here because I want to talk about Protestant liberalism, and I know I'm getting long. I want to talk about liberalism, and I want you to picture a bridge. And, you know, we talk about the word pontiff or pontifex means bridge builder, or priest actually means bridge builder. But the idea is to build a bridge between us and God. Well, think about a bridge with one end of the bridge on the bank labeled Christian experience and the other on the bank labeled modern thought. And you see the dilemma of the Protestant liberals. The closer you get to modern thought, the further you get away from the fundamentals of the faith. The closer you get to Christian experience, the more you get away from the modern thought. Now, I would even argue the Christian experience is a little bit away from the Christian truth, because experience doesn't always be a good teacher. But the Christian liberal was on one end or the other, or close to one end or the other, and so there was two groups of them. One, on the guys that were near the Christian experience end, said, "I'm a serious Christian, but I do think about modern things." The other said, "I'm a modern thought person. I think about all this stuff, and I'd like to be considered a serious Christian." But you see, the way they approach it is where they put their priorities. They either put it on the church side or they put it on the modern theory side. And this is really a struggle that's gone on today. Now, the problem with liberalism really is that the bridge, the ends are moving all the time. You know, what's modern thought and how far does it go, and what's church experience, and what, you know, it's always a moving target. And if you don't have roots based on firm principles, then you get kind of swept along with the natural movement, you know, as these banks change. But out of this liberal theology, something happened, which we want to call a Holy Spirit movement. A new shoot of move began to come out. This is in the early 1900s, because as the old tree began to decline, a new shoot comes out from the root, so to speak. The Holy Spirit was beginning to emerge. We call this Pentecostalism, and it grew out of this fundamental and liberal controversy. And a guy named Charles Fox Parham had a little Bible college in Topeka, Kansas, and he began to be convinced that he was speaking in unknown tongues, and that is accompanying the second blessing of Christian perfection. Now, I've got my caveat in there, but I'll sort of give it to you verbally. If you go into the passage that they reference for unknown tongues, what you'll find is the tongues really weren't unknown. They were like, I speak English, and if you speak French to me, I can't understand what you're saying. Or if you speak Italian to me, it's a known tongue, but it's a different tongue. It's really a language. So the word really means language there. And then they also talked about the second blessing, which was the baptism of the Holy Spirit. Now, most of us in the Christian world would say that when you're baptized by the Holy Spirit, you get the full blessing of God. There is no second blessing to come. You get the full blessing. Whether you use it or not depends on how you relate to and whether you allow the Holy Spirit to work in you. But anyway, this whole idea became very popular. And what you had was people in mainline religions beginning to go get this second blessing, and they begin speaking in these unknown tongues. And so what you had was, not only was Pentecostalism beginning to come to pass, you know, and several of these little Pentecostal groups formed the Assemblies of God, which we see today, but a lot of this stuff began to happen in Presbyterian churches and Anglican churches and other types of churches. And the question you ask yourself, the question I always ask myself, is they're probably getting the first blessing the first time, because they didn't have it before. But nevertheless, this movement has been an exciting movement in the church, and it really has driven a lot of mission work. It's all through South America now, a lot of apostolic or Pentecostal things were there. We talked about fundamentalism. Here's the definition of what it used to be. It's probably changed in the last 10 or 15 years because it's taken on a political tone. But, you know, Jesus was divine. He was born of a virgin. He died as a sacrifice for sin. He will come again. The Bible is inerrant. That those are sort of the fundamental tenets of people who go back to that, these five doctrines. It's probably changed a little bit now because it's more political than it used to be, but this is really from a doctrinal point of view. You've heard of a guy named Harry Emerson Fosdick, perhaps. He was one of the biggest liberals of all time, and Rockefeller helped him spend money on passing his stuff out. And he said, the things we stood for are tolerance, and an inclusive church, and the right to think religion through in modern terms. They call me a heretic, and I'm proud of it. But, you know, the thing is, nobody really questioned thinking about stuff in modern times. What they questioned was jettisoning God along with the thinking process. And a lot of these guys kind of pushed us into this whole new modern way of thinking. The Scopes trial, and I'm not going to go into all of this stuff, but, you know, the Scopes trial was really Darwin comes along at this time, and the ACLU gets this guy in Tennessee to say he taught evolution, and so they bring him up on trial. The actual trial ends in the fact that he's fined for teaching evolution. You don't hear that. You think about the Scopes monkey trial, and you think about the evolutionists won, but they didn't. They didn't win. They won in the court of public opinion, but they didn't win in the court of law. And so became the Butler Act in Tennessee. And so the ACLU began to do all sorts of stuff to make this come to pass. And their whole idea here was to really drive a wedge in the church and to force the church out of another fundamental belief that man is a being that comes from God and not something from pond scum to, you know, to frog to whatever to human beings. And so and they've done a pretty good job, I have to say, in the last 50 years. Of inculcating the American people with the idea that evolution is something that they can harmonize with. So he lost that case, but you never hear about that. Ecumenical movement, 1938, World Council of Churches. It's still around, but it didn't do very much to get people together. Something called Neo-Orthodoxy came up in Europe, and this is an attempt by European theologians, Karl Barth and others, to turn back to God. More of a theological and a philosophical view. But he was on the cover of Time magazine. And sandpile theory, I'm going to hold that because I'm going to talk about the sandpile theory when we talk about what comes next, because that's kind of important to understand. But out of old ideas come new ideas. And so we begin to see a lot of things happening. Age of ideology, we talked about the rise of, I think I've talked about that, haven't already. So fascism and communism, we're going to, I know we're late, I apologize. The bad idea incubator is on both sides of the equation. It's on both the left and the right. The bad idea on the right is the whole idea of fascism. It's a perversion of power and authority that vests in a single or small group of people. It allows private property, but it attempts to control everything you do with an ulterior motive behind it. So that's, we know about Hitler, we know about all the atrocities. Well, Karl Marx is actually a German. He's a German Jew, actually. And he starts this whole idea of communism, but they don't like it in Germany, and they kick him out. So he, but through a guy named, Lenin's not his real name, I can't remember what it is, Vladimir Ilyich, something, Ulyanov or something like that. But anyway, Lenin, through Lenin, it takes root in Russia, and it begins to form the Bolshevik Revolution. And the whole idea there is that the state is going to take over everything, and the common man is now going to rise up and run everything, this utopia on earth, this workers' paradise. And both are extremes, and both of them have brutal consequences, and millions of people were killed under each one of these far-out ideas. But ideology, once it gets out of the box, goes until somebody cuts it off, and that's really where we have here. Evangelism is out of the box, too, and all this stuff about fundamentalism and liberalism and ecumenical movements, all this still goes on today. We've seen some rise of powerful evangelicals. We had, I don't have Billy Sunday in here, but he's before this, but you have Billy Graham and Carl F.H. Henry. Most of you probably have, or some of you, if you have Bible commentaries, have Bible commentaries by this guy, or books by him, deeply thoughtful person. And of course, Billy Graham, one of the greatest evangelists that we have, really spans religious traditions and everything else because of a simple, powerful message. Nobody really argues much with it. And so he's probably at the point of preaching his last crusade. I mean, I don't know that he's done that, but my guess is if he hasn't, it's close. And who's taking his place? That's the question you ask yourself. Who is the next person to rise to this level? Carl, there's a lot of people who are writing books about theology. So there's a lot of heir apparents to this, and we've seen a lot of them in the churches. We probably all have commentaries by a lot of these people. But, you know, a lot of things happen in churches that we sort of float along, and we see what happens, and we kind of are wondering where it's going to go. And this is one of those things that troubles me, is where are we going on this side of our equation? You know, the Christianity Today popular magazine started by these guys. And I'm just about finished. In 1962, there was a thing called Vatican II, very important, because Vatican II took the Catholic Church out of the fortress and began to make it see and deal with the modern world. Now, there's a few things in there that are probably more inside baseball discussion than anything else, but what they did was, is they said Catholics are not deprived of significance of the mystery of salvation, which means that Catholics have heard the word, and Catholics have gotten the message about Christ and how to be saved and all of that. But the other thing they did is they removed the excommunication that they had placed on the Eastern Orthodox Church, you know, 1,500 years later, but they removed the excommunication. They also made a point, that many of the Reformation people that left the church in the 1600s left for actual cause. It wasn't heretic. They renounced the heresy policy, and they pulled that back. And then they said that they're basically going to agree on the idea that justification is by faith. And you remember before, it was always justification by faith and works. Works in the sense of following the Catholic tradition and doctrine and the edicts from the Pope and the councils and all of that, sort of the catechism of the church. And so these things made a fundamental change in the way the church operated. In addition, they changed the Mass from Latin to the native language, and a lot of Catholics began to read the Bible for the first time, began to look at the Bible. They had an okay from the priest to actually do that, and so that began to happen And the other thing, it did, and this was kind of an unintended consequence, is by the act they did, they removed much of the power and the mystery from the priesthood. So a priest in the old days had a lot of mystical power in the church, and they were highly, highly revered in the church. Once Vatican II happened, they sort of considered themselves as pastors, mere pastors, and they didn't like that role. They wanted to be the priest role, not the pastor role. And so many of them left the church. We saw a big exodus in the mid-60s from the Catholic Church. Many of them went to the Episcopals, or they went other places, or people, seminaries were down tremendously. They started having to import Catholics from South America and from Ireland and other places. They were strong because they couldn't get enough priests to run the stuff. And so a lot of things happened and to really make it better. Although one interesting thing in 2007, Benedict, our latest pope, declared that anybody who's a Christian outside the Roman Church are really ecclesial communities, and they shouldn't really be called churches in the proper sense, which is kind of a funny thing because, you know, ecclesial community is really a church. It's a called out group. It's a group called out by God to do something, which we all are. But his point really is the church, in his view, is the Roman Church. That's the big church. And because we're not part of it, we're not part of the church. I don't think there's too many evangelicals who really care much about this thought. But it is kind of an interesting thought that old traditions and old thoughts really die hard. And whether they're in the Baptist church or the Catholic church or whatever, they do. Now, I'm going to touch on this and go. We were the source of 70% of missionaries not many years ago, 40, 50 years ago. We were more than 70% of money going to missions. That's not the case any longer. More mission people come out of other places than they do for us. We're beginning to be mission field for other countries. Canada is a mission field for countries. And so a lot of mission things are happening. Two fastest growing centers are Asia and Africa. But also South America. South America is doing pretty well in terms of conversion. I question a little bit about what they're learning, but they're converting. And so most of the conversions are now happening outside of North America, which is kind of interesting. You know, with the global village and the instant communications and the TV and the satellite, we're beginning to see everything in a worldwide view, everything from the heat to the, you know, global cooling, global heating. And one of the things that's also troubling is Christianity seems to be like a brush fire. You know, it starts in Italy, it moves to Europe, it moves to England, it moves to America. But as it moves, it begins to die out in the country that it was in. And you go to Europe today and you're seeing mausoleums of churches. There's nobody there. If anybody has been to the National Cathedral in Washington, I was just there about 2 weeks ago. I hate to say it, but it's a mausoleum. It's a beautiful church that there's no spirit, no movement in it at all. It's gorgeous, like a cathedral from Europe, but it's as dead as it can be. And it's kind of a sad thing. But, you know, a lot of things are happening. We're waiting for a new revival. You know, what do we do here? And that's a subject we're going to talk about later. I've talked about that already. Generation X, what are we doing with them? What are they going to do after this is on? You can read this stuff later. This one is the one I want to say. 2 billion people a day identify themselves as Christians. 530 million are in Europe, 510 in Latin America, 390 in Africa, 300 million in Asia, 250 in North America. Kind of small by comparison. If the trends continue, the majority of Christian population will live in Latin America or Africa by the year 2025. It's kind of an interesting thought as we look at where the church is going. I've added anything. Any questions or comments, any thoughts? I know I'm long and I apologize for that. I just wanted to get this done. So, okay. No questions or comments. Let's have a word of prayer and then we'll go about business. Lord, thank you for this time that we can share, and thank you for showing us that church history is all about you moving in the lives of men and women. And Lord, your purposes will take place and your church will progress. And Lord, we just pray that as we make the decisions we make every day about who we are and what we believe and what we do and what ministries we do and what ministries we don't do, that we're always looking to you, looking to the scripture, trying to follow your guidance in our hearts.
Lord, thank you for this group of people that have come, and Lord, I just pray that they'll be safe on their journey home. Pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Thank you all.